Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, a legend, drummer, and author from AOD, Dave Scott Schwartzman, is on the show. He is part of the legendary band AOD, as I said, and also the author of the brand new, fantastic history of AOD. If it's Tuesday, this must be Walla Walla, the wacky history of Adrenaline OD. More on that in 1 second, but first, if you would like to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is where my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left4Damien. There's a YouTube page, a TikTok page, a Facebook page, and an Instagram page, all for this podcast, at turnedoutapunk on those respective platforms. And there's turnedoutapunk videos that I put up and all sorts of stuff. Whenever I find time to kind of put stuff together. And same with Tristan. He's also got other things in life to put together. But we find time to post on those things. So follow those. If you want to support the show, you can support the show by letting your friends know about this podcast. And you can also support me by heading over to the band I play in's website, fuckedup.cc. You also find fucked up on all those social media platforms. Even though we're blocked on a lot of them from sending stuff anyway, but that's a separate conversation. That's for a fucked up podcast, not Turn Into Punk. But you can head over to fuckedup.cc and find out about all the cool stuff we got going on in that band, if I do say so myself, because we are going on tour with the gods, Superchunk, along the West Coast in the new year. And then we are also putting out a bunch of records, constantly putting out records and t-shirts. And we've got some charity auctions for test presses. Find it all over at fuckedup.cc, I think. I don't go to the website too often myself, but I think it'll be all covered over there. That's it. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, the legend Dave Schwartzman is on the show today from AOD, Adrenaline OD, from New Jersey. New Jersey gods, I would go so far as to say. Like, they are a band that really unites worlds. And I knew this going into reading this book, but reading Dave's book, you totally get that sense. And even more so about all the sort of disparate worlds of not just punk, because it's also kind of veers off into metal, underground culture that they link up. There are fantastic stories about like the Misfits and Metallica and NoFX and Agnostic Front. It's wild stories that I didn't even know. And I thought I knew a couple stories. I learned a lot from this book. It's a real fun read and goes through like every stage of this band. And they are a band that you can kind of tell the story of 80s underground music post-hardcore through AOD and into the metal world and sort of the pre-Nirvana kind of grunge world. They don't really make it to that post-Nirvana era, but they do kind of tell the tale of where that world comes from in this book, in a way. Anyway, buy the book, listen to AOD, and sit back, relax, and enjoy Dave Scott Schwartzman on Turned Out a Punk. Dave, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome.
Well,
pleasure to be here.
Well, I didn't tell you this off air, but I'm a huge fan of your book. I think it's a fantastic read. And I think,
oh, thank you.
Well, I think for people like myself, you know, fans of this music, Adrenaline OD is a fascinating band because as much as you are a band very proudly of New Jersey, you're also weirdly a band kind of without a scene that kind of ties you to any one place. So you kind of wind up in a lot of weird different places and give an overview of punk throughout sort of the 80s in America.
I tried to give the audience a complete bird's eye view of what it was like to be in a punk rock band back then. And, you know, I tried to make it light because, you know, AOD was a very funny band and we had some very, very funny times on the road. So I'm happy. It turned out to be a good read.
It's funny too, because you are a band that I remember when I first got into hardcore, you know, like there was always the older person sort of cynicism from the generation above me on the bands mm-hmm. that I was getting into. And the one that was always recommended to me was AOD. And it seems like AOD is a band that is perfectly at home with, NOFX, as you and me were talking about off air, but also at the same time Metallica, but also at the same time like Agnostic Front and the Misfits and sort of this real heavy New York thing and New Jersey thing that was also happening at the same time. Like, you guys are a band that could kind of exist in all these different places simultaneously.
We were an anomaly like that, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that, when all these scene rivalries were going on, we weren't part of that. We weren't part of the New York, Boston, New York, DC rivalry. So we got along with people from DC. We were part of the original New York hardcore scene, so we got along with them. And we got along great with, bands like the FUs and DYS. We had such a diverse amount of friends. Like you said, we could be friends with somebody like NOFX, but we were also really good friends with like the Battalion of Saints, and Agnostic Front, people that, a lot of people would be just scared to hang out with, but we got along really good with everybody. We're one of those Sweden bands. We're like completely neutral.
Well, you talk about going to that International Hardcore Olympics show in LA at that point, or playing with BGK, or your friendship you kind of develop with these bands and stuff like that. Like, and I find it so fascinating because, as I've gone on, I've kind of like began to look more at punk and hardcore as being almost like religions in a way, that it holds importance to people. And in the same way, Fat Mike has a completely different definition about what punk and hardcore is than Roger Murray would have, than Doyle from the Misfits would have. And like, all these people have different definitions, yet you guys somehow seemingly fit into everyone's different definition of it.
Oh, that's a good thing, I guess, We were all fans of the music. So, it wasn't like we were just trying to be in a band to be famous. We never thought we'd get anywhere, let alone playing any shows. And we came out of like the first, punk scene. We weren't automatically just got into hardcore. The band that we were in prior, well, actually three of the guys that were in AOD was called the East Patterson Boys Choir, and they started in like 79, I think. So they were on the tail end of the 70s wave of punk, and that's what we all listened to before, stuff like Black Flag and the Germs started coming our way. We were into Dead Boys and Dickies and the Damned and the Dictators and every other band with a D in it. But
And I guess like this leads me to the question that I start every episode with, and I kind of know the answer because you do get into it in the book. But Dave, how'd you get into punk? Remember the first time you ever came across the term?
It was strictly through my sister. I had been listening to, just like every other punk kid, the gateway drug was like Kiss, Alice Cooper, Blue Oyster Cult, things like that. And I had this weird circumstance where when I was about 13, 14 years old, I got a call one day, and some lady wanted to speak to my dad, and it turned out it was his daughter. And I have a brother, but we never knew that my dad was married before and that there was a half sister someplace. So we met her. First time she was in New York City. She was going to see Led Zeppelin. She grew up in Miami, so it wasn't like we were close and or see each other a lot. She would only come up for some of these shows. In the early days, it was like Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. And over time, I realized, well, she's probably a groupie. And that's exactly what she was. But on one of the later trips, she had gotten into punk rock, probably about 78, 79. And she came up to see the Clash this time. And, she looked completely different. Her blonde hair is now like platinum white, and she's wearing like zebra, jackets and funny sunglasses. And from there, she started sending me some of the local records that were coming out of Miami for bands like The Eat and The Reactions and The Cichlids. And I was getting like the 45s from her. And then she sent me like the first Clash album. And that really, changed things for me. And the next time she came up was when the Clash were playing in New Jersey, and she got me in. And then I got to see the Clash, like first row center. So it was an amazing, amazing life-changing experience, you know. So that's really how I started getting into punk rock. She used to write for a fanzine called Mouth of the Rat, which later became Rat Cage Records when the owner Dave Parsons moved to New York and started putting out records by Agnostic Front and the Beastie Boys and stuff. But she was connected to all those people. So I even met Dave Parsons like way before any of those New York hardcore kids did, because I met him through my sister when he came up for the Clash. You know, and this is
That's
before the
awesome.
hardcore stuff happened.
That's amazing. That first wave of singles she's sending you, all that Florida stuff is so fascinating because it is. And it's even, I find this in the book when you start talking about playing with Maggot Sandwich. And I think the first comp you guys are on, Maggot Sandwich is on that comp too. It feels like Florida punk has like an extra layer of weird, cool weirdness to it, and especially that early stuff.
I mean, listen, you had to be pretty radical to be a punk rocker in Florida or Texas. I mean, look at that Texas scene. There was a gay communists that were starting punk bands in Texas. That's ballsy, man.
Well,
That's ballsy.
I think they're right, because it's like the more there's places where people needed this kind of more in a way, like obviously everywhere, but you talk about it later on when you're going down and playing with Neon Christ in Atlanta, and there's like sections of the highway that are owned by the Ku Klux Klan.
Going through the deep south. That was, you know, you had to be mindful of things like that back then. My mom was like so worried about me going through the deep south and looking too Jewish. But then like I shaved my head, and then she was really freaked out. Well, I was like, well, at least nobody's gonna really think I'm Jewish anymore. They're just gonna think I'm some like miscreant. You know, I looked like Howdy Doody and Mr. T combined.
It does feel like this is though like in a period where the bands are doing this for the first time. Like obviously bands would always be on the road, but it was a very different sort of thing than bands did post Black Flag, post DOA.
Black Flag were the ones that were like the Johnny Appleseeds for most of the East Coast scene. You know, they would come through and they'd have their own sound system, so they were able to play like halls or whatever place they could set up. And they played a lot. I mean, they were always coming through. And that, you know, it really it gives bands that are smaller the idea that, hey, maybe we can do this too, you know, maybe it's not impossible. I mean, it took us a long time just to even put out a record, because it seemed like the financing was just so hard to get back then. You know, you couldn't record a record like in your home on a computer. You know, it's like there was so much we had to learn, you know, and we messed up on a lot of things along the way too, and made a lot of mistakes, but that's what happens, you know.
Yeah, going back to your sister, was she into bands like Milk and Cookies? And like, did she know like Lydia Lunch and other girls that were kind of on the scene back then?
I don't really know. Like you talk about the band from Brooklyn, Milk and Cookies, like the power
Yeah,
pop
Milk and Cookies.
band.
Yeah, the kind of like they were being, I guess, like the direct precursor almost to that New York thing, it seems, like the New York
Yeah,
punk thing.
because she grew up in Miami, I don't think she had too much access to that scene, you know. She was really into that local Miami scene. There was a lot going on back then, you know. There was a place called the Agora Ballroom. And it was also Chrysalis Studios, where like the Dead Boys went and recorded their album, and she hung out with them when they were recording the album, you know. So there was always something going on in that area, you
Yeah,
know.
absolutely. Yeah. And it feels like there's like that sort of pre-punk stuff that was happening. There's like the sort of storied groupie scene out in Los Angeles around that time too, with around Rodney's English Disco, and a lot of the people that would be foundational to like the early punk scene. Yeah, Lydia Lunch, when she talked about it when she was on the podcast, being kind of like part of this sort of groupie thing before she discovered this music and this punk thing.
I mean, you know, think about how early she started. Yeah, she was just a kid with Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, you know. It was a long time ago, you know, and that was such cutting edge music for its day. Like the minimalism, that wasn't something that, you know, was part of the tri-state area, you know, radio stations playlist back then. You didn't hear a lot of Teenage Jesus and the Jerks on the Springsteen stations, you know.
Well, that's why New York's so fascinating to me at that moment where you're kind of getting into this stuff and first discovering this music, because it hasn't really been kind of codified and broken into subgenres in the way it would be a few years later. So there's still stuff that sounds like Suicide existing with stuff that sounds like Blondie and, the Dots or the Mumps and the
Well,
Mad.
that's why I loved the original beginnings of the New York hardcore scene, because there was no blueprint. Every band that was on the scene back then, Kraut, False Prophets, The Mob, Reagan Youth, The Undead, everyone had a different sound and a different style, and different influences. So, it was too early for things to get generic back then, which of course it eventually happened, years later. But it was much more interesting and a little bit more arty of a scene,
Yeah,
But
you definitely get that. You definitely get that there's like you look at the bands like the Stimulators or the Mad or all this sort of stuff, in addition to the bands that you kind of mentioned, where you do have kids that are openly gay, you have a lot of women involved in it. Like it does feel like it isn't sort of like what's normally taken up as sort of macho hardcore or what.
I think the Bad Brains came to town and just like blew everybody's minds. And like once the Bad Brains happened, everybody changed, I mean, you started getting harder and harder bands. It became a lot more macho, later on, a lot more fights at shows, But the Bad Brains did change the entire landscape of my area. Once we saw them, it's like, well, how do we be that good?
Yeah, it seems like they had that effect also when they started touring. Like everywhere they went, people after they saw them were like, okay, we gotta do things slightly differently or step it up.
Yeah, I mean, first time I saw them, I'd had only heard the Pay to Come single. And I saw them at Max's Kansas City the first time. They were wearing the suits and they had the short hair. And man, it was just like somebody just like hit a lightning bolt into the fucking building and it just exploded. And for like, 35, 40 minutes, it was just like, I thought the Clash were the shit after I saw them. And now I'm watching something that is on such a different level on energy. I'm like, wow, holy shit. It was
Yeah.
really one of those holy shit moments,
It's also interesting. I rewatched America's Hardcore not too long ago, and there's a story in it that Henry Rollins kind of tells, and it's almost become like one of the great fables of punk, where the teen idols do that tour out to the West Coast and they go to a Circle Jerk show and they see, the rise of West Coast hardcore, the organized sort of gang pit activity and kids wearing the boots. And Henry straight up says, like, we kind of brought that back to DC. And then you have the stories of, DC and Boston coming to New York and there being sort of fights at first. And then eventually New York gets a lot tougher out of this. And it's interesting to kind of see that, like you're talking about, the original version of hardcore kind of gets supplanted almost by this like reinterpretation of West Coast hardcore that kind of spreads.
I was at a lot of those early shows that the DC kids came to, like Black Flag at Irving Plaza and Circle Jerks at Irving Plaza. And they were very hard on the dance floor, man. They were not there to, they were really looking to hurt some people, And I remember I met like one guy from DC. His name was Jake. I don't know if he was in a band or anything, but he was a really big dude. He was like 6'3" and had like a big chain around his belt, and he's wearing a leather jacket. He's like, "Just stay with me, kid. You'll be okay." That's what I did. I stayed behind him the whole night.
But there is that, yeah, there's that thing that kind of happens with hardcore where it does get more violent and it does get, a little more aggro and yeah, it just
But
becomes
it's an
this.
aggressive form of music, the whole point of it is to get all that crap out of you, screaming out, slamming out, do what you want to to get this release. So it is, the music itself is aggressive. The lyrics in many cases are aggressive. A lot of the people sometimes are aggressive. Some of these kids came from bad homes. Some came from no homes, You had kids in the New York scene that were actually street kids.
Yeah,
like I always felt weird coming, you know, around some of these kids and going back to my, you know, suburban house afterwards, you know, because I knew that some of these kids were actually just living outside.
Well, yeah, because it is this sort of great economic equalizing place where it doesn't matter where you come from in terms of your financial background, but at the same time, it does always matter where you come from. Like you're talking about, if you have a lot of money, you can put out a record. You can have access to these resources, or, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, by the same nature, like a lot of these kids, I imagine in the early days were going to these shows to try and escape the violence that they were kind of seeing around them.
Yeah. For a lot of us, I mean, you know, living in New Jersey and being into the punk rock, you got picked on a lot, you know. It's like we lived in an area in New Jersey, you know, where it was very much a Guido mentality, if you want to call it that. You know, the dudes with the chains and the wife beater shirts and the hair greased back, and they'd attack me in packs, you know, like kill the punk rockers, hey yo, you know. But that, you know, I've been chased through shopping malls. You know, me and my friends have been chased through town. You know, it's funny now. Like you walk around and you see all these kids with colored hair and tattoos and piercings, and nobody gives them a second look. You know, it's like you have no idea what it was like to be like that back in the early 80s. You know, because people, it was a threat to people. It actually was a threat to their way of life, you know, to see somebody like that, you know, and they'd let you know it.
And also, it felt like it was a lot more. Even by the time I was getting into it a few years later, the walls were a lot higher back then in terms of like the things that divided these scenes, and like slight differences made all the difference. Like, it was like, I find it fascinating looking at New Jersey, like the fact that, at least to me as an outsider observer, there's almost like different punk scenes happening simultaneously. Like there's, and maybe this develops over time, but there's like the Buy-R Records kind of scene of bands.
Right.
There's the Mother Records kind of scene of bands.
Correct.
There's like the Feelies kind of world of bands. And then there's like almost like the Mental Abuse, I guess, Urinal Records kind of world. I guess Roger's from there too, in New Jersey as well.
Yeah. He's from Northern New Jersey. Actually, he grew up in Passaic, the town right over from where I grew up. And New Jersey is pretty big. A lot of people don't realize it. And we kind of break it up into three sections. There's like Northern New Jersey, which is like people that went to the New York shows. There's Central New Jersey, which was like the New Brunswick area, which had a lot of shows. And then that also encompassed like the Shore crowd, like all those Mother Records bands that you were talking about. And then South Jersey had City Gardens in Trenton, which was also part, those kids went to the Philly shows. So it's kind of like three scenes in one. And being a band from New Jersey, we were able to, you know, play the state many times over. So it wasn't always like you were playing the same place, which is kind of neat.
Mm-hmm. But would there be a lot of interaction between those Mother Records bands? They don't seem to come up too much in the book.
It's weird that those bands were like an island unto themselves. It wasn't until later that we all started kind of co-mingling. I think Jacko, who was the singer for Fatal Rage, was probably like our first friend from that scene. And then Russell from the band Underdog, and he was in Murphy's Law.
Child Abuse, too, right? Was he in?
Yeah, correct, right. And, you know, I'd say it's weird. Everybody's got their guard up when you first meet somebody, you know, especially back then. And I think that everybody's guards were up when we first met each other. And it took, you know, some hanging out and seeing that we're all cool people to actually be friends. And, you know, we'd have parties with those guys later on, you know.
So it's also interesting as time goes on and there becomes fewer of you standing around and the island gets smaller and smaller. You end up standing beside people you didn't know you were going to be standing beside.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, one thing about AOD, which is probably the same with a lot of punk bands from our area, we have a long, long list of dead friends, you know, and it started early. You know, it's like, you know, my mom lives in a retirement center. I have more dead friends than she does, you know, and it's because that New York scene that we were a part of, also those early punks, they really got into the hard drugs and it killed off a lot of them. You know,
Yeah.
And you know, it's what happens. You know, I stayed away from that shit. I was straight edge back then, but I had a girlfriend, and this wasn't written about in the book. But I was in a 10-year relationship, living relationship with a really bad heroin addict. And when I met her, she was part of the punk scene. I thought, you know, I'm straight edge. I'll fix it. Not a problem. You know, I had no idea what heroin does to a person, you know? Mm. And it was like 10 years of some shit, man, you know? And there's just so many people that needlessly got into that. And a lot of it was the lure around Johnny Thunders, you know, for a lot of those early punk rockers. They got into that whole, this is what punk is supposed to be. You go out a show, you get as fucked up as possible. No pun intended. And this is, you know, this is what happened with a lot. That's why when the early hardcore scene started in New York, you weren't seeing a lot of the older punks come to these shows. They were either on drugs, too arty for this crowd, or died, you know? Mm-hmm. So that stimulators crowd that was going to stim shows, that was like, you know, late 79, early 80, around there. They were young kids that were starting to go to those shows, you know, because the old people stopped coming, you know?
Yeah.
So it became that's how the whole youthful hardcore scene kind of started. The old people just kind of died off and got into drugs or went away or had families, you know? It's like, as somebody that was really interested in like the history of punk like you, I wish there was more older punks on that scene to talk to about the old days, because I'm fascinated by that shit, you know? Mm-hmm. Anything that happened before my era, I'm fascinated with. But there weren't a lot of people, you know? There weren't a lot of people that were over, you know, 25 or 30 back then, you know?
It's morbidly fascinating to look at how opioids, heroin in particular, it's so baked into punk from the very beginning, even like proto-punk, right? Like you look at, you know, stuff by the Velvet Underground, and there's almost, yeah, even when it's giving the reality, there's still a romanticizing of it that kind of happens. And
well, in my hometown of Clifton, we had a band you might have heard of from, they were considered a New York City band, but they were really from my town. They were called the Violators.
Yeah,
they put out a song called New York Ripper. And they were really influenced by that whole Sid Vicious, Johnny Thunder scene. And again, it's like this whole contingent of heroin addicts like popped up in my town. You know, the singer eventually died, you know?
Yeah, but it happened. It's still to this day, though. It's like it's once again, it's morbidly fascinating that it's still like, I still lose friends to this sort of thing, that by now there's enough cautionary tales, but
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it's like you said earlier, it's like we're all drawn to this because we need it. And a lot of times that's because there's trauma, and you know, like that can cause violence in some cases. It can also cause self-destructive behaviors and
sure. Escapism, and you know?
Yeah. And there's like a distrust of authority and this sort of like Johnny Thunders, Sid Vicious, Darby Crash, Kurt Cobain. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's just something that does not seem to go away, and it starts very early.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've had some friends that even like tried to dabble in it. And like within like a day or two, they were completely, how the hell do I get off this? You know, and it's just one of those things, like knowing what you know about it, why would you even want to try it? Mm-hmm. Why? You know, I don't get it anymore, you know?
But then you got to wonder if these cautionary tales also become part of the romance of it too. Like,
that's probably it.
Maybe I'll get a little bit of what made Johnny Thunders great if I try just a little bit of this, and I won't get all the problems.
Well, you know, with like the New York area, you know, because it was so prevalent with heroin back in the day, when they would talk in the news about some strain that was killing people, there were people lining up trying to find that drug because they thought it was so pure. You know, it's like people were, you know,
it's the same thing with fentanyl now, where like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a nightmare scenario. And to see friends still wind up getting sucked into it. It's yeah, it's just this great tragedy that's associated with this thing.
It is.
Did you like, I guess going back to, you know, slightly more cheery topics, did you ever see The Mad?
I never did, but Paul from AOD did. He had seen them at Max's Kansas City, and they show in before they play this video that Screaming Mad George had made of like somebody like pulling out her eyeball, and then like all this crazy like special effects that he was doing, and it made our singer nauseous, and he had to go and throw up in the Max's bathroom because of it. I still make fun of him to this day. I never got to see them though. I wish I did. They're a cool band. We were on the New York Thrash comp with them too, you know?
Yeah, that comp is such a legendary document. Like, it's one of the all-time great records. Like, I feel like if it had come out on vinyl back then, especially, it would be kind of like on even revered on another level. But I think because it was on a tape, it somehow got around more.
Yeah, I'm just glad it didn't come out on 8-track, or it really would have fucked things up, you know? Yes. yeah, you know, it's like, you know, now you never think about like putting out a major compilation on cassette only, you know, that's nutty. But back then, I guess it, you know, financially worked for him, you know?
Well, there's a lot of great cassettes on there too. And he was putting out stuff like, once again, like that just is so much wider than capital H hardcore.
Right.
Where he's putting out like Glenn Branca records and Richard.
Right. Hale, right. James Chance. Yeah. They had a lot of good stuff on there.
Yeah. A lot of fantastic stuff. And it is something that got like really well distributed, right? Like, it was all over the world.
Yeah. It did very well. I mean, New York Thrash is pretty much our entry point into the world. And as soon as that happened, it made everything so much easier for us, getting shows, you know, getting people to distribute our record, you know, it really got out there. It helped us a lot.
Yeah. And it feels like around then as well, there's a lot of those DIY tape comps. Like, you guys are on one super early on, as I said, with Maggot Sandwich, mm-hmm. and D-Cry, I think, is on that comp too. And it felt like there was, like with punk rock, there obviously is an international network, but with hardcore, it's really when it starts getting established in tape trading circuits and MRR, and it really changes.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially worldwide too. You know, we were getting probably more mail from places like Germany in 84 than we were from the US, you know, and even our first record got bootlegged over there, you know, because it wasn't getting the distribution. So they're like, well, somebody's got to do it, you know?
Yeah, but it still happens today with Germany.
Yeah, America, yeah, yeah.
It definitely, yeah, it does become like an international network. And you talk about going to the MRR house at one point in the book when you're talking about going to the Bay Area and kind of like mm-hmm. Tim Yohannan. And this is obviously a very small scene that there's not a ton of you guys that are part of this scene at that time. But you think about the impact MRR had internationally, where I've talked to people from Indonesia that talk about that being the foundation of their scene, or, you know, you talk about that getting into Australia, or just the international network that Max and Rock and Roll helped foster in hardcore.
They pretty much were like an encyclopedia of punk rock for people that are getting into it. You know, those scene review reports and record reviews were how you would find out about bands, you know, and what was going on in the scene. And it got around pretty well back in those days. You know, they had a good underground distribution network, and they're good people. I had a great time every time we hung out with them. You know, I was lucky enough to be, I started off as a scene reporter for Jersey, and then I got my own column after a while. So that was fun. And I missed Tim. I miss his awful, disgusting record collection with all the tape over it. He had green duct tape on the edges of every record he ever owned. And I'll never forget, like, looking through some of his records, and, you know, he's got like the first Necros record. He's got like the Misfits stuff, and it's all covered in green duct tape. And I was like, oh God. You know, it's like writing your name on the cover of every like really rare record in Sharpie, you know?
Well, it's the sort of thing that I find so fascinating about Max Rock and Roll, and this philosophy of like trying to decommodify punk and hardcore, like to mm-hmm. try and strip it of all that sort of edifice and get it down to like sort of this like utilitarian tool of the proletariat to entertain and to educate.
Right. I mean, they had some ways it backfired on them in some areas, you know. It spurned, you know, people that didn't agree with their politics, and you know, there was a little rebellion back in the day. But you know, I always looked at, you know, Maximum Rock and Roll as like flip side was like great, but they seem more local to the LA area. Maximum Rock and Roll really covered the entire world, you know. And now that would be a lot easier to do with a guy, you know, a computer blog or something. But back in those days, they actually had to print that stuff up all the time and get it out there. And you know, that's a lot of work. It was a lot of work. People don't realize how much work it was.
Well, and that's what I love is that there's sort of this like-mindedness philosophy to this being an international music scene. Like you said, Flipside is very much to me, it's a very important magazine and changed music, but it's very much a keeping of a tradition of music magazines and the function of a music magazine, where I think Max Rock and Roll feels like, yeah, it was like about fostering this international community. And it's obviously Tim, Jeff Bale, Jell-O Biafra, I think Pusshead
Ruth
stuff that,
Schwartz.
yeah, exactly. Like these people that were. And then they attracted more people from all over the world, like yourselves, that were like not necessarily just looking at this as being a music, but looking at this as being something larger and a global thing.
I mean, for me, I always knew that this was going to be something that encompassed the rest of my life. A lot of people, you know, they got into it for a fad, they got out of it, but you kind of knew who those people were. You know, the ones that really loved to go record shopping and really had the thirst for knowledge about this shit, we're all still into it, you know.
Yeah, and it's fascinating how early that is established, like the idea of like what is a hardcore kid versus like a punk rock kid, and the idea of like a hardcore, like you said, a record collector or someone that's has friends that live all over the world because you trade tapes or trade records with people that exist in other places, and just things that people around you in high school could never begin to understand. Like just
Oh,
so,
absolutely.
so far out of the realm for most people.
You know, I was able to get a lot of kids into my high from my high school into punk rock because we did our first show at a battle of the bands at my high school. And I think that it set a lot of kids that would probably never have gotten into punk rock on the course of punk rock, which, yay, I did something good. You know?
Absolutely. When you and you do see that, like you have certain high schools, certain scenes where there's a ton of kids that get into stuff. And it's always fascinating to me because yeah, I think it maybe takes a good band like yourselves for people to get behind or something, because I was not able to have that success in my high school years of converting people.
We had actually a few bands that came out of like Sacred Denial came out of my school. Let's see, there was a band called No Democracy. It was a band called Suburbicide that was on the Meat House compilation that also came out of my high school.
Oh.
So like some of them actually went on to do some stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to actually ask you, and now I'm blanking on the name of it, but there's that label that was done by, I believe, Mike from Ween or Dean from Ween. And it was like Ween's on the tape, John Worster's band, Psychotic Norman's on the tape, Social Decay is on one of the tapes, comp tapes. And it feels like that's
Okay,
another scene.
that's like the South Jersey into the Pennsylvania area scene. So I'm not really too sure about that one.
It's so fascinating when you like break down like who's in these shows and in these tiny little club spaces at the time, like be it people from Ween to Rick Rubin with Hoes to Moby with That and Commandos
You
to.
know, and it's weird because like all three of those people you mentioned, I remember them all from shows. Dean Ween would come to the AOD shows at City Gardens. Which who else did you just mention? Very important.
Rick Rubin from
Oh, Rick
Hoes.
Rubin. When I would go see the Dead Kennedys for the first time, Rick used to have, he just looked like Fred Flintstone before that beard came in. He would always have the 5 o'clock shadow, and he'd have a jacket that said his band name, which was The Pricks at the time. And underneath it said, "Too Late to Pray." And it had like an explosion going off. And I always remember that guy. And then when he started doing interviews, I was like, it's him. It's that guy. And it was Rick Rubin. I've actually gone to like parties at the NYU dorms that he was DJing at, and the Beastie Boys were running around, and Jimmy from Murphy's Law. So there was some fun times around that era.
Yeah, it's amazing where it's I guess it's like punk is this flashpoint that attracts, obviously damaged in some cases kids, but like creative kids that need somewhere to be to find an outlet, and then they find the outlet in here and this run all over the place with that energy.
All it takes is just not to feel like 100% like you fit in with everybody you're going to school with. You just feel a little bit alienated. That's all it takes to find something like punk rock. It's like the place for like the Island of Misfit Toys. It's
Yeah.
where all the broken kids go.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And then the reverberations of it, like in that Max Rock and Roll chapter, you briefly mentioned Donnie the Punk being at that house that day. And I didn't know this till recently, but Donnie the Punk is one of the people that originally coined the term pride for gay pride.
I did not know that at all.
Nor did I. He was one of like three NYU students, or I guess just New York students, I don't know what universities in particular, students at the time, that were kind of organizing a official event around the rising uprisings that had happened at Stonewall, and was one of the three people that coined the is credited with coining the term pride.
That's not something I ever knew. Donnie was a very serious person, and he interviewed us for Flipside, and he just didn't get the AOD sense of humor because he had been through a lot. He had been locked up in military prison, and I remember when we were hanging out, we were talking about just now the Maximum Rock and Roll House. Well, one of the times that we were out there staying for 2 weeks, Donnie the Punk was out there. And one thing I remember about Donnie, we had a party one night for our roadie Frank's birthday. And we had like a pack house. We just invited like every punk we saw in the area and brought up to the Tim's house. We had Battalion of Saints there, Jello was there. And Donnie was there, and he was so proud of his punk rock t-shirts that I kid you not, he wore about 10 of them at the same time. And you'd see him with the shirt, and then he'd walk away, and he'd come back, and he's got a different shirt on. And he would just peel off his shirt and put it in the back room. And now he's wearing like, a Wasted Youth shirt. And then, 5 minutes later, he's got an Undead shirt. And then, like, 5 minutes later, he's got another band. It's like, what the hell? But that's what he did. He would like wear. I don't know what the whole thing was about, but he enjoyed t-shirts an awful lot.
He was ahead of a curve. That sounds like $80,000 worth of t-shirts in today's money.
He could have been a quick change artist, could have gotten like America's Got Talent or something.
That's awesome. Well, there's like, yeah, I guess there's like so many personalities and characters as well.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, and some of those characters rose to the top. Like, people like Billy Milano and Jimmy from Murphy's Law, they're not quiet, shy people,
No.
so it's like you knew you hear something.
Well, I find it also one of the things that is fascinating is that it's in the second chapter where you talk about the Misfits. At the end, you tell that story about the melee that happens at the Misfits show, and then in the end, it's revealed that it's Roger and from Agnostic Front and Billy at the center of this thing.
Roger probably didn't want Glenn to ever find that out, to be honest with you. But I told him, like, when we had talked about this, like the only things that Glenn finds funny are like if somebody like fell and hurt themselves, or if there was some kind of violent episode. So him jumping off the stage to actually get in a fight with Roger, that's he would find that funny that years
Oh, yeah.
later that Roger was the one that was heckling him. He would have found that funny. So
I know another thing that Glenn loves from stories I've heard from friends, and I know you love because you bring it up in the book, is pro wrestling.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I find that's an interesting through line throughout punk too, is a sort of like punk wrestling connection.
It was very DIY, like punk was, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. It had a lot of similarities, you know? Very low budget, like punk rock was. Very underground, like punk rock was. I mean, you'd have to... The early wrestling stuff, I mean, before, like, you know, the Hulk Hogan, WrestleMania stuff happened, you know, we were going to, like, local high schools to see, you know, these matches and stuff. And we would do things like root for the bad guys, which would really piss everybody off around us. You know, it's like, you know, like somebody like the Iron Sheik comes out and, you know, we're screaming, you know, Iran number one, you know, and the old ladies, they took it serious, you know? So it's like, they got to give us the finger and stuff. And it was fun.
It's interesting too, because they are, you're right, they're so similar. Like, both are subverting their chosen mediums and pointing out the absurdity. With punk, it's rock and roll. With wrestling, it's sports.
Right.
But the differences are, one is like, hey, you in the crowd, come up here and try it. Anyone can do it. And the other one's like, don't you fucking
don't even think
curtain.
About it.
Yeah. Don't look behind this curtain, kid. I'm going to break your nose.
You know, I remember one time when I was at the college I was going to, they were having wrestling there. And I was like, they were looking for volunteers to be security. So I got to stand in front of the dressing room door. And I'll never forget, Sergeant Slaughter got done with, like, a match with Kamala, the Ugandan giant. You know, Kamala just grunts. He doesn't speak English. And then Iron Sheik gets done, and they're all in the dressing room, and they're like, hey, Kamala, you going to go to that diner down the street? He's like, I don't know if I want another fucking diner. And that Iron Sheik's like, listen, I'm fucking hungry. I need to eat something. Let's just fucking go. And it was like such a funny thing to see behind the scenes that they're just normal people. They're, you know, it's just a job, you know?
Well, that's why I think the Misfits are like one of the few bands. There were a couple bands, obviously, that also did it, where so much of punk is about breaking down that mystique and about here's right. who we really are.
Yeah.
Real people, like that kind of Max rock and roll philosophy.
Sure.
And wrestling is the complete opposite of, like, build the character, use that to obscure the truth.
Well, the Misfits in general were like that. They were very, they were not approachable. Mm-hmm. They weren't doing local New Jersey shows and putting New Jersey bands on the bill. You know, they weren't part of the scene. They were just kind of their own little entity, you know?
Yeah.
And they would only play usually once a year around Halloween. And, you know, the Misfits that people know now, it's like, it was so different. Like, they were like a cult band for me and my friends. Like, they were like our favorite band. And it was like, we seemed like we were the only ones that knew them back then, you know, aside from a couple record collectors that managed to get the 45s. But, you know, for us, it was like having the Beatles in the next town over from you, you know. It was cool. I'd be a kid. I'd ride my bike over to Jerry Doyle's house and just sit outside the gate and listen to rehearsals, you know, or go over with Steve Zing and listen, because, you know, we were friends before I met the Misfits, you know. And yeah. We were both such Misfits fans, the two of us. I mean, he got his dream, man. He works for Glenn. So, you know, being in Danzig, but that dude... Yeah, he got his dream job.
Well, because, yeah, I guess, were there, like, bands like Rosemary's Babies and the Undead? Like, would they kind of did they have, like, bands that were part of this Misfits Island, or are they truly, like, just unto themselves?
They were unto themselves. Rosemary's Baby did, if I remember correctly, one show with the Misfits. And that was, you know, Erie was their photographer, so that's why they got the gig.
Yeah.
And that was at Gildersleeves in New York. And, Steve's band, Morning Noise, never played with the Misfits until recently, when they opened for him at, you know, at the Arena show in New Jersey, which was very nice of Glenn to, you know, give him that opportunity, because they never had it back in the day.
Oh, it's so wild, too, because, yeah, I just assumed they would have played together back in the day. But, yeah, it's very much like its own thing, which I always thought, like, Misfits are simultaneously the greatest punk band ever and not at all a punk band.
Yeah, you know. The early days, I mean, you know, like that, the Static Age record, That was for me and my friends. That was like a cassette that would get passed around, and, you know, and the quality was so shitty because it got transferred a billion times over. But we knew those songs, you know, for years and years and years, you know. And I really loved that era of the Misfits, like, you know, the pre-Doyle era, you know, the pre-Walk Among Us era. I thought that was like one of the, like, Static Age, if it came out when it was supposed to, and I think it was like 78, something like that, it would have been one of the best punk rock records ever made at the time, you know.
Yeah, it's wild to think about it coming out then, how different it was.
Yeah, for sure. It may have changed, like, what the Misfits became. I don't know. I never really cared too much for, like, the cartoony aspect they got a little later on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a little bit too comic book, or, you know, for me. I don't know.
Well, it's like you said earlier, it's like the Kiss of punk, and you can
see. Well, Jerry always wanted to be the punk rock Kiss. That's what he shot for. And God bless him, he's got it now, huh?
Yeah, they got into pro wrestling and they became the punk rock version of Kiss. I think that's all the check marks on the list of what to do.
Yep.
Kind of. You talk about it in the book, but you did play on one of the all time great humor institutions of Uncle Floyd.
Mm.
That must have been. Was that like something that was like a dream leading up to it too for you a little bit, or was it?
We had tried to get on that show for years. And I don't know why it never happened, but our break came when Randy now, who books City Gardens in Trenton, took over booking the show, and he got us in Diglo Abortions and about, you know, five punk bands in a row on the show. I mean, we grew up with Uncle Floyd. For us, you know, that was part of, like, as big as punk was, Uncle Floyd was just as big for us, you know, the whole tri-state area, because we found out about so many bands from watching the Uncle Floyd show. You know, that show was on when I was a kid in junior high school, and you could turn on that show and, you know, there's Steve Bader's one day, or the Ramones, or David Johansen, or like a ton of local bands, you know, the Colors and all the Bees and all these bands that, you know, you only find records of, you know, for a lot of money on Discogs now. They, you know, they played on that show. So I always wanted to be on that show. I'm glad it finally happened.
Colors are super underrated too. That band's fucking awesome.
Yeah, Colors were great. Man, there was a great power pop scene in that area, the Colors and the Speedies.
Yes. You
know, I loved all of them. But my favorite was Nasty Facts from
Brooklyn. Love Nasty Facts.
They were, man, that was like, that scratched my musical itch, man. Their record is like one of the best three songs that just club you over the head with youthful exuberance and hooks. Perfect playing. Just a great record.
There was like the Dots too, I guess, or another kind of power pop band from that era as well. There felt like there was this sort of really forgotten about the power pop moment before like New York hardcore, I guess, really truly takes over.
Yeah, and it was going side by side for a while there too. Like in New Jersey, we had a place called the Dirt Club. And, you know, Dirt Club slowly started having hardcore shows on Thursday nights. But all the other nights were like power pop bands. That's where like the Smithereens started in that scene. And they put out like two compilations. One was called Hardcore Takes Over, which was a hardcore comp. But the first one was Live at the Dirt. And it's got like the Colors are on there and the Bounce and all these like little known power pop bands. It's a great comp. Really good.
Both those comps are fantastic. And I think that Hardcore Takeover cover image has been used as for a bootleg cover as well.
Yeah, that's my friends Andy and Harpo from Nibla Kenbane. Yeah, two of my oldest friends.
Well, there's, I guess that's a whole other thing, is that Headache Records scene that kind of pops up too.
Yep, that came up around late 80s. There was a club popped up in Jersey called The Pipeline. And that became like a central point for the entire scene. They had all kinds of great shows here. Everybody from like traveling hardcore bands like DOA to early techno bands like Nine Inch Nails before anybody would book them would play there, you know? So it had a great, great scene. And it was another good example of like a punk rock club in the middle of the worst fucking neighborhood, because it was right in the projects in Newark. you know? And it's like, you walk a block away, you're not going to have a good time, you know? Yeah, so, like, you know, but we were a compact little unit and just stayed on our block, you know? And it was a great place, fun times.
It feels like towards the late 80s, also hardcore begins to change. It happens in New York. I guess famously, you have like sort of like the CBGB scene, which when CB shuts down, you have the ABC, you know, Rio thing pop up, and then other whole sort of scenes that kind of pop up in the wake. Did you, obviously, you guys kind of break up at 88 by the time 88 rolls around? Did you feel that already happening?
Actually, we didn't break up till 91.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
91. Sorry.
Yeah.
We didn't break up till like 91. Did you already see that beginning to happen? Like, could you see it in New Jersey too?
Oh, yeah. You know, for us, there was a couple things that were obvious. We overplayed the hell out of our area. You know, 10 years of being in a band, people get sick of you after a while.
Yeah.
Second thing was, when that whole youth movement happened, like the Youth of Today bands and stuff like that, and the more hardcore stuff like the Biohazards, we started going back to our punk rock roots and kind of withdrew from the thrash and went more into power pop and punk for our record Cruising with Elvis and Bigfoot's UFO. Now, we alienated a fuckload of fans by doing that too, you know, but we kind of knew that was going to happen. But we did what we wanted to do, because that's what we set out to do with the band anyway. We always said, if it stops being fun, we're going to quit. Because that's the only reason we wanted to do it, was to have fun.
And I feel like that's the natural life cycle of a hardcore band. Like, at a certain point, you're going to have to change your sound, or just because the scene will change and you won't necessarily feel like you fit in anymore.
Sure. And if you're a band, like, you know, like we put out Humongous Fungus Among Us, we played as fast as we could possibly play. Where do we go from there? You know, I mean, do we get faster or do we stay the same? That would be boring. We were all starting to learn our instruments around that time too. I mean, you know, when we went to record Humongous Fungus, we had just gotten back from a 3.5 month tour and went like 4 days after coming home, went right into the studio, you know? And that's why we're so goddamn fast on that record, because we had been playing every night for 3.5 months. It's perfect time to record. But after that, we started listening to stuff like the Avengers and the Dickies and the Monkees, and there was less and less hardcore stuff on our drives, you know? So I think it was a natural progression to kind of get away from the thrash stuff a little bit, you know? And we were at a weird point that not a lot of bands were ever in. After Humongous, like every metal label wanted to sign us, you know? Every crossover label, Metal Blade, Megaforce, every one of them was trying to sign us. And it's like, we're not like that crossover band, you know? It's like, I like Slayer and Metallica and Anthrax, but I don't want to be that kind of band. I'm a punk rocker. And there's a big difference in that and the thrash metal stuff, you know? At least to me at the time, there was. And, you know, could we have sold out? Yeah. It could have changed our, you know, where we are now? Probably. But would I feel good about it? Probably not, you know?
Well, it's not like it for any of the bands that did kind of go and sort of chase that direction. I can't think of too many that it really like worked for, that's the sound that they're known for today.
And
that's
right. Like Agnostic Front tried it, but you know, if they went back to the roots, right, in the long run.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a lot of it. You know, some bands tried it and didn't work out too good for them, like Discharge. Woo! Man, I remember seeing them at the Ritz in New York City. I've never seen so much garbage thrown at a band in my entire life, dude. And they came out with the long hair and like the Iron Maiden. That was it, man.
It's interesting. Go on, sorry.
No, I was just going to say they destroyed the hearts of like every skinhead in the audience that day.
It's funny because you see it happen with the Boston bands too around the same era.
Yeah, they were all into like, I think it was like people like John Sox and from the FUs and some of the older guys that were into Ozzy and Black Sabbath, and I think that's how that whole thing started happening. But yeah, they all went off the deep end, you know, with the metal thing, you know, and it and the records that they all did that were more of the metal influence, they all kind of sucked, you know? I mean, if you're going to listen to an SSD record, you're not going to put on the last one, you know? You're going to put on, you know, the first two albums were fucking killer, you know?
Yeah, they're perfect. Just
yeah.
And I guess that's like you're saying, like once you've achieved your own perfection, like where do you go with your sound? And these moments,
that depends on how good of a musician you become, I guess, you know.
Yeah, there's very few bands though to think of that kind of kept the name and changed the sound that didn't wind up pissing off the fan base. Melvins, yeah. Maybe, but the Melvins, I guess, never really had a sound that you could pin down.
Right. They were like their own thing, you know, and that's why they were grunge before there was grunge. So they have outlasted everything at this point. Good guys, too. I'm in touch with Buzzo all the time.
Yeah. Very, very, very important band. And obviously a band that never got bad and just continued to kind of like just uncompromisingly do things on their own terms. But it's hard to do that. It's hard to think that like
right thing. Yeah, that's it. You know, I remember it was probably around 87 that we first started hearing people say play faster at our shows. And, you know, it's like the longer we went on, that was like, it was like the rallying cry of our audience, play faster, play faster. And our stuff purposely started slowing down because of that, you know, it's like, yeah, we already played fast.
Well, I think Black Flag's the one that gets labeled for doing it, or like the one that gets pointed to. But I think every band, that's your natural reaction when people are screaming at you to do something. You're like, well, you're going to, of course, lean to the opposite.
Right, exactly. And AOD, we're all about like choosing the path of most resistance. we liked taking the piss out of things. You know, it's like, We would play CBGB's matinee shows and our guitar player Bruce would be in his underwear, you know? Yeah. And these guys are trying to like stage dive and mosh around him and he's just in his underwear. You know, it's like there was something to be said about being purposely funny. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we could amuse ourselves a lot. And we did amuse ourselves a lot and sometimes at idiots' expenses, which were great, you know? It's like I like when people don't realize you're being made fun of, you know?
It feels like New York around like 85, 86, there's a lot of bands that are doing faster hardcore, like right? New York City Mayhem and I guess Scared Straight and like pre-SOD stuff. Like it felt like there was a sort of like a hardcore thrash non-crossover thing.
Yes. There was some bands that went back early on. I remember Leeway, one of the first hardcore bands that was metal influenced in our scene, like early on. And you know, later on, I mean, once the crossover scene happened, like the whole aesthetics of the CBGB scene kind of changed too, you know?
Yeah.
And it's funny because AOD, one of our matinees, I think maybe like 84, was the first time that the guys in Anthrax ever went to a hardcore show. And I remember being introduced to them and Scott was like terrified. He was completely into it. Like he so wanted to go into the pit, but he was so scared that he was going to get the shit kicked out of him that he just stayed by us, by our merch area. He's like, I'm just going to watch from down here. And I saw him come to like, you know, later shows like Agnostic Front, and gradually he got braver and braver. And there were people that said, hey, listen, nobody's going to fuck with you, you know, and they were the insider people. So they were cool. You know, yeah. We had plenty of guys in the scene with long hair in the pit, and it wasn't like skinheads were fucking them up. It wasn't that kind of thing, you know, but a lot of the fights came from just people being idiots, you know, being too aggressive or hitting a girl on the dance floor or something. You know, I remember one fight happened when a singer of a band threw a beer bottle into the crowd and it broke right either on or near Vinny Stigma. And they chased this band outside the club and beat the crap out of them. And years later, that band would be known as Social Distortion. So it was Mike Ness. And Mike Ness got the crap beat out of him at CBGB's for throwing a bottle at Vinny Stigma.
That's
early days, 84 maybe.
Yeah, it feels like there's few people that would be worse to wind up hitting with a bottle.
I've seen some bands, I think might have been Fang. One of the San Francisco bands got chased, like the whole band got chased out by the entire audience that wanted to beat them up. I was sitting outside at the time. I don't even know what the hell happened. I just remember the band locking themselves in their van and everybody smacking on the windows. And New York was always an interesting place.
Yeah, because like New York, it was, you might get robbed by the people that just happen to be around the venue at the show, or you might get robbed by someone at the show.
I've seen all kinds of shit. And I mean, we've had to come inside because of gunshots, you know. That area where the A7 Club, it was literally the worst fucking neighborhood in all of New York, you know. It's now it's like Starbucks and people with their strollers and their kids and shit. But in those days, Tompkins Square Park at night, you did not go in there unless you were copping drugs or, you know, you had a death wish. You know, kid like me, suburban kid from New Jersey, would not walk around those streets by myself. You know, the guys in AOD were older than me. So like Paul was always kind of like looking out for me. And you know, if I had to go someplace, he would make sure that there was always a couple people, you know, if we were going to the car or something to grab equipment, you know, we just wouldn't walk alone, you know.
It's amazing how that neighborhood is also such a storied place for punk rock, going back to that first sort of punk scene to the A7 scene to that last G.G. Allin show where he's wandering around that neighborhood after the set, right, trying to get away from people. And it's like it's just something about that neighborhood prior to now, where I guess there's no real venues that can afford to be there anymore, but that just seemed to be a magical scary place for punk.
It was, I mean, the one thing that made it cool was that you knew that if you were there, you're okay, because there were enough people always around outside, and some of our crowd were pretty intimidating looking, you know. But I mean, even in A7, I talk about this in the book, I was on the dance floor, I think it was for Reagan Youth, and A7 was the size of like a living room. It was really small. And I was doing the little circle pit with everybody, and somebody like sucker punched me from behind. And it was like this little Spanish guy. And I like got in his face like, what the fuck, dude? And Jimmy from Murphy's Law grabs me and pushes me over to the other side of the room. And he whispers in my ear, don't fuck with that guy. He works for the Hitmen, who's a local Puerto Rican drug gang in the neighborhood. And the dude had a machete hanging out of the back of his belt loop. And I didn't know it at the time. Now, I'm thinking I'm being all fucking trying to stand my ground. But this little dickbag from suburban New Jersey could have gotten killed that night, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like sometimes you just have to take a step back and really appreciate where you are at all times and be concerned for your own safety, you know? And I learned that night, you know, because that could have turned out very poorly for me, you know?
And it is such a, and I'd say this almost every episode now, but so forgive me, but it's almost like this double helix of things that are happening, or multiple helixes of things that are happening at the same time. And punk is this place where worlds that would not otherwise converge.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and yeah, like people from different experiences and bringing that experiences into the place. And occasionally things get out of balance and, you know, scenes get too heavy and too violent or get too removed from the reality or different things happen. But when it's all working perfectly, this is a place where everyone can kind of get together and be.
Absolutely. One. There was something communal about it. And there was a camaraderie that, hey, we might not like that guy, but if that guy's getting fucked with by somebody that's not part of our crew, we're going to have his back, you know?
Yeah.
And there was that kind of mentality, and you had to have that mentality because there was too many people that really wanted to mess with us, you know?
So the other band from New Jersey that I think crosses over a little bit more with some of the New York bands is Mental Abuse. Were they a band that you guys had a lot of run-ins with? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We knew them very well. We covered Sock Women on one of our EPs, the Mental Abuse song. And Sid Sludge, their singer, used to be in a group called the Out Group, if I'm not mistaken, even before Mental Abuse. So he's been around since the punk days. But yeah, they're legendary in our state, you know. We had a great radio station, WFMU, and the Pat Duncan Show, and Pat would play all the local bands. So it really gave the scene a boost because he would even play cassette demos, you know. So if you had some new band that just started and you can get a boom box into a re rehearsal room and record it, you're going to get on Pat Duncan's show and you're going to get heard in the tri-state area, you know. And Mental Abuse got played a lot. Pat liked them a lot. So they were like one of the bands that everybody knew.
For me, that station was where I first heard The Best Show, which is one of my favorite comedy kind of radio shows. And but like it's there's this sort of comedy thing that I associate with stuff that's related to punk in New Jersey and hardcore and a sense of humor that these bands have. And it's almost like the AOD DNA that kind of permeates all this stuff.
But it's really because that's the way our friends are. I mean, we bust balls and we're sarcastic assholes and we like fucking fun, you know? And I think there's just a lot of like-minded people in our state. We might have influenced some people to have their band kind of be like that, but you know, when we're hanging out, that's the way we kind of all were, you know? Of course, there's some more serious people, but you know, for the most part, it's like everybody just wanted to have a good time and party, you know, didn't take anything too serious, you know.
Well, in the book, you talk about playing in Detroit a couple times with the promoter Scary Carey, and I think it's the show at Greystones that with the Asexuals that John Kastner actually talked about when he was on the show, that they when they played that show with you guys there. And I love that Detroit scene around that time. There's a lot of weird, freaky local bands from that scene around then. I wonder if you played with any local bands you remember from back then or any weird happenings.
I remember playing like the first time we played a bowling alley with Battalion of Saints. This was even before Scary Carey had booked us. And we played with a band called like Manimals. They were like Misfits, but with like they also had the muscles like the Misfits, but they were kind of a little more metal.
One of the
They
worst records of all time, that Manimals LP.
you know what I'm talking
Oh,
about.
absolutely incredible.
I remember them. Then when we started playing like the Greystone, I remember playing there with a band called Sloth, but they were from like New York. I don't remember who like the local Detroit bands were at the time, to be honest with you. I mean, we didn't get to play with any of the legendary, like, you know, Process of Elimination bands there or anything. You know, I would have liked to have played with Negative Approach, you know, in Detroit or something. You know, that would have been cool.
There's
But I
this
did get to,
like, oh, go on, sorry.
I was gonna say, I did get to see the Process tour though.
Oh,
And
that's an amazing tour.
it was Agnostic Front's very first show was opening up for the Process of Elimination tour at 2+2 in New York City. They're
Damn.
horrible. It was before Roger. And
Yes.
they were so comical because they were all just scene kids, you know. Vinny hired these guys for the band because he liked the way they danced. Okay. So nobody really knew how to play. And I remember they had, I think, might have been Robbie Crip Crash from Cause for Alarm playing drums for him back then. And he's just doing that mosh beat. And Vinny and the bass player and the singer, John Watson, throw down their instruments and just start moshing into the crowd with just a drummer playing. So it's like there's only a drummer on stage and like the band is in the pit. I thought that was the funniest thing I ever fucking seen.
Oh, that's amazing. You'll be, yeah, because like later on in Detroit, there's Depression Records with Boom and the Legion of Doom,
Oh, I know
who,
Boom. Yeah. He lived
yeah.
in Jersey for a while.
Oh, really? Because he played in a lot of different bands too, right? Like later on, I think he did Plainfield, maybe, or something
Don't
like that.
know. I remember him like hanging out with those guys, Andy and Harpo from the Hardcore Takes Over cover. I think he might have played in a band called New Jersey's Finest for a little bit with them when he was there.
Oh, that's wild.
I remember Boom.
That's awesome. Apparently, they used to pick up roadkill on the way to shows and then show up and throw like dead deers around the pit. All sorts of craziness.
I'm glad I missed that one. I do remember the feeders, the legendary feeder show at Gilman Street. That was
because it's you guys and NOFX that played that show, right?
No, it wasn't NOFX. It was AOD and Mr. T Experience.
Oh, Fat Mike said it was fucking him that played it. That fucking liar.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah, go on. Tell me, please. This is one of the most storied shows ever.
Okay, this is funny because we're coming to play Gilman Street, and Tim Yohannan is booking it. And I'm very good friends with Tim at this time. And he's like, who do you want to have open for you? And I was thinking about it, and I was like, well, I just got that Mr. T Experience record. I like that. He's like, okay. I was like, well, I know that band, The Feeders, just moved to San Francisco. He's like, yeah, but I'll let you know in advance. They never, ever play live. To get them to play is like pulling teeth. That's what he says, but I'll try. And he calls him back a couple days later. He's like, hey, they said they'll do it. And I was like, oh, awesome. All right. So I'm like, oh, this is great. I finally get to see The Feeders. I love this band. And this was the most fucked up show I've ever been to in my life. It starts off where their singer, Frank Discussion, comes out and he's got a dead dog wrapped around his neck and a dead cat on a noose that's hanging off his jacket. Now, we're talking like Gilman Street, Maximum Rock and Roll, PC capital of the fucking world here. Right off the bat, people are going fucking apeshit. And he takes the dog off and he said, Lassie's come home, and he throws it into the pit, and then they start playing. Okay, so now it's like it's already starting up, and there's a bunch of girls start coming on stage, and they're trying to grab the mic from him, and he's grabbing the mic back, and they're throwing water at each other. He does a show. Now, Frank Discussion is bald, and on top of his head, he's got live cockroaches glued upside down, so their little legs are moving all over his head. And it just gets better and better. Jello had come to see us. Biafra's at the show because we're friends with him. They bring Jello's ex-wife, Nanochka, up, who had just left Jello for a Frank Discussion from The Feeders. She cleaned out his bank account, by the way, and took off with Frank. So now they bring her up there, and like Jello's in fucking tears and leaves the fucking place. And then their last song, they have this big gigantic basket on the stage, and like nobody knew what the fuck the basket was about. They pull off the cover of the basket, and there's a guy spit and sputtering. He's crippled and he's in a wheelchair and he's spazzing out, and they went into this song Basket Case, I think, and it just devolved into chaos and this gigantic like audience versus the band debate. And I remember Frank Discussion saying the animals were already dead, we got them from the SPCA, and the crowd's like, get off the stage, go away. But the whole thing is on video. Tim recorded the whole thing, and it's on YouTube. You can watch the whole thing.
I think it's parts of it are, I think they've taken down the whole video now, and it's just that chunks.
Okay,
because I first saw that in the Research Pranks video, where Frank Discussion has a segment and they've got clips of the video in that. And it was,
okay,
existed on the tape trading circuit amongst tape trader punk fans for a long time. But yeah, that is one of the most,
well, I think it's the insane.
Feeders, yeah. The Feeders in general, like, are just one of those bands where it's just too punk for its own good.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But that was one of the craziest shows that we ever did. We still have people talking about that one. I ran into Matt Freeman from Rancid years and years later, and I introduced myself to him. He's like, dude, I saw you guys with The Feeders. And I was like, oh my God, you're at that show. And him and the singer of Rancid, Tim, both worked for Gilman. They had to clean up the fucking place that day.
Yeah. So. It's wild when you think about all the punk venues that have come and gone, and then you think about all the insanity that has happened at the Gilman, and somehow it's survived.
Right? Crazy. Crazy.
There's a story about Tim finding a dead baby there.
I never heard that before.
Yeah. It's a bleak one. Anyway, this has been awesome, Dave. And anytime you want to come back on this podcast and talk about any of this stuff, please know the door is always open.
Well, excellent, man. And I'm glad you liked the book. And anybody that wants to get it, go to dwolf.com and pick up a copy. I'm working on the screenplay now. It's going to be a movie.
Thank you, Dave, for coming on the show. And hopefully we'll get to do a part two with Dave at some point in the future, because there's a lot more to talk about. This book is fantastic. And I recommend you go out there and pick it up wherever you can. If it's Tuesday, this must be Walla Walla, The Wacky History of Adrenaline OD. And this was put out by Die Wolf Publishing. And you can get it online. I'm sure you can find it everywhere. Great book. All right, on to the next episode. And boy, do I have a great episode for you coming up. My buddy, my pal, and I are reconnecting after a few years since we had last spoken. And my gosh, what a ride it's been for him. Kurt Vile is on the show. We talk about all sorts of stuff, including the tour we did together. And yeah, it's a good one. I can't wait for you to hear it. And that is coming up on the next episode. Now, remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. And stop hating violence towards people of different faiths or races. And I know I say this all the time, and this might seem corny to some people, but it's because this isn't politics. This is just basic human rights stuff. And it's scary right now looking at people trying to pull things backwards and push things back to a different time and place. So if there's organizations around you that are doing positive work to bring about a better world, get involved. Donate your time, or, you know, if you have money, maybe they need money, because there's a lot of groups that are doing a lot of hard work right now and trying to raise money for a lot of great causes. And I'm sure there's some in your community that need your support. Speaking of needing your support, do something in for your punk scene. You know, start a band, start a fanzine, start a website. No one knows websites anymore. Zines are back, but websites, that's a dying art. You know, we talked about all the great websites on the last episode, Kill from the Heart and Break My Face. And there was a lot of them back then. So maybe start a website or start a podcast. There's too many of these, but start a podcast too. But just do something, because this culture gets better when you contribute to it. And anyone can contribute to it. That's what makes this so amazing. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore. And I've seen it with my own eyes. That does perform miracles for people. And people can live on even through a tragedy, like you passing away and then harvesting your organs. But you're dead, so you don't really need them. It's not like that Monty Python sketch that was ripped off by You Can't Do That on Television. Like, wholesale, they ripped off that sketch. Try meditating. I know people have been saying this for thousands of years, and there have been people that have been very well aware of this practice and know far more about it than I do, but I find I get benefit even with my limited knowledge about it. So try it. It takes a couple times before it starts feeling good, but then you find these things just enter your normal life, and try it. Who knows where it goes? Anyway, thanks for listening. See you on the next episode.